I want to talk a little bit about rhythms of practice, and how important it is to understand that practice, spiritual practice and life in general, involves rhythms, waves. Waves come and they go, there's the peaks and the valleys, and that it's a lot easier to engage in a spiritual practice or meditation practice if you have a sense of that you're working with the rhythms. And in thinking about this, I was reminded of Suzuki Roshi, Zen master in San Francisco, who summarized Buddhist teachings in three words. And those three words are, not always so. So, you might want to take that as a profound statement, since he wants to summarize all of Buddhism in those three words, not always so. And I see in many people engaged in spiritual life, a tendency at times to want things to be one way, or to get some kind of wonderful spiritual teaching that is profound and wonderful, and assume this is how I'm supposed to be all the time. And I'm supposed to be always supposed to be, you know, concentrated. Or I'm always supposed to be spacious and open. Or I'm always supposed to be one with everything. Or I'm always supposed to be, something, some way. And it creates a certain kind of problem if we think we're always supposed to be a certain way, because that's not how life works. Not always so. Things are always changing and moving and fluxing, and there's a rhythm and movement in it all. So how do we work with the rhythms of a life if we're not going to hold on to one particular way as being the way? So rhythms. I'm not sure where the best place to start is, but I'll start this way. For one of the classic ways of classic rhythms in Buddhism, back to the time of the Buddha, was the rhythm of going on 3-month retreats and then going back into the world, engaging in the world. And this is what the monastics did. The monastics would spend what's called the rains period, the rains retreat, in one place, not wandering around, basically on retreat. After that 3-month period was over, they would scatter and they'd wander around the countryside. And this still idea still exists in some Buddhist countries today. Certainly in Thailand, and they have that still today. In Korea, they have that where they have 2 3-month practice periods in Zen monasteries. And the monks gather for the practice period. The day the practice period is over, they scatter and they roam around Korea, and they come back for the next one. And the idea of this rhythm of kind of being an intensive practice environment and then leaving it behind and going out into the world provides a wonderful complementarity. And one of them is that the retreat time is a time certainly of being inward, of focusing, finding out what's going on inside. And then when we go out into the world, we're in part testing what we've learned, testing what our realization is, testing what's really happening. And I've known a lot of people who've been on retreat too long, and they think they're really hot stuff. And then, you know, they go off and into the world, do something. They go to Bangkok if they're in Thailand, or they have 2 kids or something. and they realize that, things are a little different than what I thought they were like. And some people will flee back onto retreat at this point. That's where, I need to always be a spiritual person. I can only do it on retreat, so let me go back there. But the time in the world is really a time of seeing many aspects of ourselves, growing, testing, revealing. In a sense, then getting more material to work with when we go back on retreat. It also works the other way, is that sometimes when we live a life that's active in the world, we can fool ourselves. We can think there that, oh, things are going fine, or I'm engaged in certain things in a great way. And in fact, we're not realizing that there are tensions and pressures and issues that are bubbling up inside or inside that are masked by always being busy. And so by stopping in some radical way, like going on a retreat, allows for this stuff to bubble up. So I saw that even sitting here with you today, that I had something happen earlier this week that I kind of, it was okay. You know, I don't have to deal with that. It's just a small little issue. I just, it'll take care of itself or whatever. And so I was sitting here peacefully this morning, minding my own business. And up comes these strong thoughts, almost like some pressure. Oh, that thing. And I could feel, now I could have just said, oh, I'm not supposed to be thinking about the past, right? I'm supposed to be here, present. But when you open to the present, one of the things that happens is it allows for the pressures, internal pressures, to move up, to pop up. And that was one of the pressures inside of me, was this thing that happened on Wednesday. So I realized, oh, I need to take care of this. But I wouldn't have realized that unless I'd stopped. I think I would have gone on with my life, probably. So that happened in the sitting today. It happens in bigger ways the longer you go on retreat. If you go on a weekend retreat or one-day retreat, it allows for the kind of surface chatter to quiet enough to allow some deeper stuff to appear. If you go on a three-month retreat, a lot of stuff passes away, and you'd be surprised at the deep, deep stuff. Sometimes it can bubble up. That can only bubble up if you really kind of, have that extended period of silence. So, in a sense, daily life tests our meditation practice, our retreat practice, and meditation practice and retreat practice tests our daily life. They help reveal each other. They inform each other. They work together. So there's a rhythm there, going back and forth, and it's important, I think, to play that rhythm and go back and forth. And different people have different ways they work that rhythm. And sometimes I think it's kind of an intuitive one for people who like to go on retreats to know when they should go on retreat and when they should withdraw. Some people spend a long periods of time doing a lot of retreats. Some people will like to, one a year. Some people do it, intensively for several years, and then they don't do it for several years, and then they go back and do it for some time. There's a rhythm to when it's appropriate and how to do this. With this rhythm of going back and forth into the world, I first started to realize or appreciate the value of this when I was at Tassajara, the Zen monastery. And there, rather than leaving the monastery at the end of the retreat time, the world came to you. And so what happens there in the summer is it becomes a resort. So in the winter, it's this very intense, very serious Zen monastery. In the summer, you have all these guests coming in for the good food, for the hot springs, for the good beds, the cabin, and it's like you can't believe the difference. People walking around in their bathing suits and their bottles of wine into the dining room, and you've been a strict monk all winter. And I found the 3 years I spent at Tassajara, the rhythm of the summer and the winter being very important. By the end of the winter, I was ready for the summer, and the summer I was ready for the winter. And I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about my practice by the alternation of going kind of this more active, engaged in the world kind of mode, and this mode that was inner. The other thing I learned at Tassajara was that in part, we learn who we are by being very still, very introspective, being able to look very deeply inside of ourselves. And in part, we learn who we are by engaging in the world. That aspects of who we are don't become revealed unless we engage. And Buddhist spirituality sometimes lends itself to over-prioritizing being still, being silent, just watching, especially Vipassana practice. It's just about watching and seeing. And one of the things I learned in Zen practice is that it's not only about realization or seeing, it's also about manifesting. And there's a rhythm between realizing and manifesting. Sometimes they're not so separate, and sometimes they're quite separate. So one of the things I learned at the monastery was that I discovered who I was by engaging in different activities. Because there, sometimes every 3 or 4 months, you would change your job. And I had more jobs in the monastery than most people have sometimes in a lifetime. I was a cook and carpenter and kind of, guest manager and, altar boy and, a variety of things. And gardener. And sometimes I headed crews of people. Sometimes I worked alone. And in all the different situations I found myself in, it called on different aspects of myself, and it challenged different aspects of myself. And I saw parts of myself in the certain settings that I wouldn't, if I'd always been in the kitchen, I would have kind of seen myself as a cook. But I wouldn't learn how I was as, a carpenter. It's different skills, different challenges. So we learn partly who we are by silence, seeing, introspection. And we learn partly who we are by being engaged, by manifesting, which partly means taking risks. And if you think you can only learn about yourself by being quiet, then you're shortchanging the possibilities. Now, most of us are mostly learning about ourselves actively. So as an antidote to that, most of us need more time quiet. But both are needed, and the rhythm of going back and forth. There's just that little saying. The idea of being an individual. You're supposed to be, find yourself and be yourself in America as an individual. It makes as much sense to be yourself as, as it does to speak your own language. Imagine speaking your own language. I'm going to speak my own language. I'm an individualist. I'm not going to, I'm going to have my own language for myself. That's great, but languages are for communication. And if you have your own language, no one's going to understand you. To be yourself doesn't exist in isolation. It's also something that exists in relationship. If you're only finding yourself independent of relationship, you're only finding out part of who you are. And if you find yourself out only in relationship, you're only finding out part of who you are. You find out who you are in the kind of more totality of it all by being able to go back and forth. For people who only know about who they are in relationship or trying to negotiate their life only in relationship, Buddhism has a lot to offer in learning who we are free of relationship. For people who have been Buddhist for too long, kind of gotten lost in the world of, the world of independence, of being free of relationship, then maybe it's important to kind of get back involved in relationship to find out who we are, to have the kind of, the package be whole. And going back and forth. So, the rhythms. There's the rhythm of sitting every day. And if some people like that rhythm. And they find that sitting every day is kind of a truth teller, kind of reveals what's going on in our life and lets us process things and work things through. They see that, and so there's a rhythm of going and sitting and then not sitting, sitting and not sitting. When I first started doing sitting alone every day, I sat twice a day, it was done after spending 2 weeks at the San Francisco Zen Center. So that became my model of how to sit on a daily basis. And the model there was, I don't know why, it wasn't a Japanese idea, but the model there was they sat basically 2 days, twice a day, but they didn't sit on Sunday. And so I thought, oh, that's great. So I sat for 2 years, I sat alone every day, twice a day, 40 minutes, but I didn't sit on Sunday. And I don't know the wisdom of that, but I think there's some wisdom to that, of kind of doing this twice a day is pretty big thing. But then having one day you're not doing it. You're free of that. So you're not holding on to some model or some way. So you let some integration happening, something else happen. So it's like you do yoga, right? And at the end of yoga, there's often this time where you do the corpse pose. And the way that's been explained to me, the value of it, it's a time of integration. It's kind of letting all the kind of things that happen in yoga kind of sort themselves out in your body and settle out. And it's a really important time. If you just jump up from the last intense pose, you don't allow that settling to happen. or the rhythm of learning a skill. You need time off to learn also. If you only spent learning, you don't have the time to the deeper integration that happens. It's been pointed out that some of the integration happens in sleep. And if you don't give yourself enough sleep, it's difficult actually to learn, because you need the sleep time for the mind to kind of process what you're learning. Or when I was a kid, we used to go skiing. And I was always surprised that at the beginning of the next ski season, I could ski better than I could at the end of the previous one. And I wasn't skiing for 6 months or 8 months. But it's something happens in the off time, behind the scenes, some integration, some working out, some sorting out of the neural pathways, I guess. Who knows? So, the rhythm of on and off and on and off, the off time is as important as the on time. So, for some people, meditation is the off time, but then you need off time from the meditation. So the Sunday was the day off back then. So, then there's a very interesting rhythm. And this gets into kind of more the heart of meditation. And that is the rhythm of being concentrated and not concentrated, being present and not present. We sometimes will hold up the ideal, I'm supposed to be concentrated. And when you find your mind drifting away, that's bad news. You don't want your spiritual friends to know that. Or you're supposed to be, present all the time, and you find yourself not present. But the mind, I don't think, has the ability to be locked on in a concentrated way forever. You can't do it. You can do it for some extended periods of time. It's possible to do it. The most extreme or highest capacity of having one point of concentration that the Buddhist tradition apparently mentions is that human beings have the ability to do it for 7 days and seven nights. That's the outer extreme. That's only amazing yogis. The ones who kind of can lock themselves in a box and be buried in the ground. So sooner or later, between now and 7 days, your concentration is going to go. And what's your attitude about that? And I know a lot of Buddhist practitioners whose attitude around the concentration going is not very wise. I blew it there. But the mind can't stay concentrated. It can't stay in the present moment all the time. The mind is not a thing that is fixed. The mind is like waves and rhythms that move and flux and change. And so how do we work that? How do we work the rhythm? How do we work, rather than how do we fight it? If you're out in the ocean or standing where it's, maybe up to your shoulders, and these big waves come along, you don't stand there kind of like this, right? You have to, in order to kind of not be submerged, you have to kind of know how to kind of move with the waves, right? So how do we move with the waves of the mind, the patterns of the mind, the rhythms of the mind? So there's a natural rhythm. A natural may be a dangerous word to use here, but there's a rhythm between being present, being concentrated, and then not being. So you stay present for a little while, and then the mind wanders off in thought. When that mind wanders off in thought, rather than being upset and saying, "Oh, I'm not doing the practice right," I would suggest the attitude. I don't know if it's the right. It was true, but anyway, suggested as a strategic attitude that when the mind wanders away in thought, take the attitude that it needed to do that. It's part of the rhythm. And as soon as you notice the mind has wandered off, your job in this play, is to contribute to that part of the rhythm that comes back. As soon as you can. But not to fight the rhythm, not to feel it was wrong that it happened. It happened because it had to happen. And then your job is to come back. Now, if you notice yourself wandering away, and you think what you're wandering away about is really great, And let's think about that some more. Then you're not playing the rhythm. If you're playing working the rhythm, as soon as you notice, you have to be able to start coming back, be present again. And you can do that, and then the mind pulls you out. You come back, pulls you out. And sometimes it's very quick. And so slowly as you work it, and you get calmer, more settled, because you're working it, you stay more and more present. You know, how quickly you go out, or how long you go out, how far you go out, becomes smaller and smaller. And you get smaller and smaller rhythms. You're working, massaging the mind rather than holding the mind. Kind of like you're massaging a muscle that's tight. You know, usually you don't kind of just put your fist or your thumb into the tight muscle and just hold it there. I think maybe there are some techniques like that, but normally we don't do that. You know, we alternate. You know, push in, let go, push in, let go. And then slowly the muscle learns to relax. The mind also relaxes a lot faster and easier if we have a sense we're being massaged. We're working with it. We're cooperating with it. We're kind of working the rhythms. And it's certainly a lot better, that attitude, than the attitude of, oh no. Oh no, I've been lost. This is terrible. It shouldn't happen. Oh, it happens. Come back. Come back. You're kind of working. And the more you work it, the more you get involved in that sense of working it and massaging it, I think you are being present, and you're working yourself into being more and more present. So working that rhythm. And the movements away might be necessary. Just like for me today, as I sat here and started being present, I was getting calmer and more present, more open. At some point, that allowed for this pressure that was inside to bubble up. And what I had to see then was, oh, there's this issue in my life that I have to look at. And then I worked with that, and that settled. And then you're kind of working that rhythm. So there's rhythms. And there's rhythms of selfing, of becoming a self, of self-identity. There's rhythms of what interests us. There's rhythms of emotional life. The emotions come and they go. They move through us. Emotions have lives. And it's not like they have just like a linear life. They have kind of a wave-like life within us. And certain emotions arise, they're there, they fade for a while, they might get stronger again. And so how do we work that rhythm? So we're not opposing it, but we're working with it in a useful way. And I think one of the useful ways is to have a sense that it's rhythms. Very intense emotions are more manageable for some people when they have a sense that it's part of a rhythm. Oh, this is just the intense peak of the rhythm. As opposed to, uh-oh, this is it. And some intense peaks can last for a few minutes, a few hours, a few days, sometimes longer. But they'll actually last, the rhythms of emotional life will be very short the freer we are with it, the less attached, less resistance we are with it. Arising and passing, arising and passing. I wanted to read this quote. This was written almost 20 years ago when someone visited South Africa during the peak of the apartheid times. So you can see the little things being maybe symbolic meaning for something else. South Africa, it's time perhaps, maybe your life now. A compassionate person seeing a butterfly struggling to free itself from its cocoon and wanting to help very gently loosened the filaments to form an opening. The butterfly was freed, emerging from the cocoon and fluttered about but could not fly. What the compassionate person did not know was that only through the birth struggle can the wings grow strong enough for flight. Its shortened life was spent on the ground. It never knew freedom. It never really lived. So there's a rhythm there of struggle and maybe letting go. Struggle is part of life. Engaging, effort is part of life. And certain things don't grow and develop unless we engage. And I've seen some Buddhists who think that it's all about letting go and being calm. Well, sometimes it's a struggle to do that. But there's not one way to be. And learning to kind of ride the rhythms and go with the changes and not to recognize when we're holding on to an old view or fixed view, this is how I'm supposed to be. So we don't limit ourselves, but can flow back and forth. There's also an alternation between being focused on ourselves and focused on others. When do we pay attention to others, offer ourselves to others for their service, and when is that too much, and when do we lose ourselves in that? By going back and forth, having a sense of rhythms, we actually can find the right balance. If it's only one way, it's hard to be balanced. So meditation, for example, is maybe a time to be more for yourself, in a sense. And then that allows a greater possibility for being present for others in a richer way. I find, we talked about this the other day, some of us, I find that when I'm in conversation with someone, I don't have a fixed mode of how I am in that conversation, like just fully present for that person. But rather, what my mind is doing, it's actually has a rhythm of going back and forth. And there are times when I'm very acutely paying attention to the person I'm talking to, and other times where I pay attention to what's going on within me, how it is listening, my thoughts, my reactions, my feelings, my motivations. And sometimes I get lost in one or the other. Sometimes I do get, I'm listening, and sometimes I'm paying too much attention inside and have to ask them to repeat themselves. But ideally, I'm going back and forth and monitoring the conversation to know kind of where the attention should be. But it needs to be back and forth so I can track it all. If I'm only tracking the other person, it's dangerous. If I'm only tracking myself, it's not useful. Let's go back and forth. There's a rhythm, going in and out, being present. So having said all this, I'd like to read now a poem by Rick Fields. This is the very short sutra on the meeting of the Buddha and the goddess. Now most Buddha sutras start by the expression, "Thus have I heard." But this one's a little bit more honest. "Thus I have made up." Once the Buddha was walking along the forest path in the oak grove at Ojai. Walking without arriving anywhere, or having any thought of arriving or not arriving, and lotuses shining with the morning dew miraculously appeared under every step, soft as silk beneath the toes of the Buddha. When suddenly, out of the turquoise sky, dancing in front of his half-shut inward-looking eyes, shimmering like a rainbow or a spider's web, transparent as the dew on a lotus flower, the goddess appeared quivering like a hummingbird in the air before him. She, for she surely was a she, as the Buddha could clearly see with his eye of discriminating awareness, was mostly red in color, though when the light shifted, she flashed like a rainbow. She was naked, except for the usual flower ornaments goddesses wear. Her long blue hair was deep blue, her two eyes fathomless pits of space, and her third eye a bloodshot ring of fire. The Buddha folded his hands together and greeted the goddess thus, "O goddess, why are you blocking my path? Before I saw you, I was happily going nowhere. Now I'm not sure where to go." " You can go around me, said the goddess, twirling on her heels like a bird darting away. But just a little away. But just a little way away. Or you can come after me. This is my forest too. You can't pretend I'm not here. With that, the Buddha sat, supple as a snake, solid as a rock, beneath a bow tree that sprang full-leaved to shade him. Perhaps we should have a chat, he said. After years of arduous practice, at the time of the morning star, I penetrated reality. And now, wait, not so fast, Buddha. I am reality. The earth stood still. The oceans paused. The wind listened. 1,000 arhats, bodhisattvas, and dakinis magically appeared to hear what would happen in the conversation. I know I take my life in my hand, said the Buddha, but I am known as the fearless one, so here goes. And he and the goddess, without further words, exchanged glances. Light rays like sunbeams shot forth so bright that even Shariputra, the all-seeing one, had to turn away. And then they exchanged mind. There was a great silence as vast as the universe that contains everything. And then they exchanged bodies and clothes. And the Buddha arose as the goddess, and the goddess arose as the Buddha. And so on, back and forth, for 100,000 kalpas. If you meet the Buddha, you meet the goddess. If you meet the goddess, you meet the Buddha. Not only that, this. The Buddha is the goddess. The goddess is the Buddha. And not only that, this. The Buddha is emptiness. The goddess is bliss. And that is what and what not you are. It's true. And so here comes the mantra of the goddess and the Buddha. The unsurpassed non-dual mantra. Just say this mantra, just to hear this mantra once, just to hear one word of this mantra once, makes everything the way it truly is. The mantra is, okay. So as we began, we end. So the Buddha penetrated reality, but the goddess is reality. The Buddha and the goddess are the same. So if you think that you have seen, understood what reality is, then your job is to become it, to be it, to manifest it, to express it. Don't hold back. And if you don't hold back and go out and engage in the world, then make sure to give yourself time to pull back so you can see also. Both are needed. So may you have the wisdom to go back and forth in all the waves and rhythms of your life. So we have 5 minutes to have your thoughts or reactions. We can have the rhythm can go this way also. I can shut up. What would you like to say? No, it's not for yours, not for our sake, but other people.
Have you ever not meditated for a long time and then come back and found that, like you're skiing, that you were right there more efficiently? Or
so I'm back. So have I sometimes not meditated for some time and then started meditating and found that I was just right there when I started again? Yeah, sometimes I've had that experience. And sometimes I've gone a couple of weeks without meditating, and then when I sat down, it felt so satisfying. It was, wow, I'm right here. It's so great to be here. But actually, what I often find then too, that I'm right here, but I'm right here at a coarser level. And then as I keep sitting, I realize that it's relatively coarse. And then my mind starts wandering away again after a few minutes or a few hours or a few days. And then I have to kind of work through a whole layer of stuff that's built up because I wasn't sitting. That sitting is a way that I process stuff or stay clear. And that if I don't do it enough, it's like, you know, if you don't... you know, it's like if you don't clean yourself for a couple of months, right? Then you take a shower and soap, you know, 5 minute shower and soap, and you feel, wow, soap really works. I got clean. But you didn't really get clean. You got clean, you know, 20%. You need to spend a few more, a little bit longer in the bath to really get the grime off. So that I found. And sometimes I found if I take, you know, some time off, I come back to meditate, and sometimes, I'm really scattered. Sometimes I recommend to people who do a period of intensive practice, like 3 months or sometimes longer, that they take a period and take a real vacation. Like if they're in Thailand, I'll say, you know, great if you were spent, you know, the last 8 months in retreat or now. Go down to the beaches in Thailand and hang out on the beach for 2 weeks. Don't meditate. And just to see what happens, to kind of integrate what happened and kind of see something different that you can't see if you stay in the monastic environment. Yes.
Thank you for your talk. I really enjoyed it. For the mantra, okay, I saw a car on the way over here that said, oh no, oh no, on the license plate. About your talk, I was thinking about the word manifesting. I don't think I've heard it before in a Dharma talk, and yet we do manifest our lives. And when our mind, sort of when the grosser, not meaning ugly, but grosser, larger obstacles of our mind seem to dissipate, then these more subtle, what may be subtle or not so subtle, layers of mind or thought or beliefs are still in some way doing their manifesting, even if our mind sometimes is empty or seems to be empty of that, then occasionally our mind falls back into these thoughts and beliefs, or this is my perception or guess of what's happening. And so what I was wondering is, how do we access that material, which is probably stuff that we got in some way imprinted over our lifespan, or we allowed to be imprinted in some way? How do we get to those thoughts and beliefs? Because you can have just a fleeting thought and it draws that to you. Sure. Whatever you, and even the Buddha, I guess he did talk about manifesting in one way. Is someone mentioned that he did say, whatever you reflect on, you attract, or grows bigger or becomes more. So sometimes people in retreat say, oh, let's meditate on how many times you feel greedy. Well, gosh, that's not what I want. Anyway, that aside, so if these thoughts are coming up, anyway.
So the question is, if there's, even in deep meditation, quiet meditation, there might still be a layer of subtle thoughts that are hard to access that might be there influencing your views, your experience, your activity.
Right, I was actually thinking about regular daily life, not to be separate from meditation, but yes. And so do they talk about how that's really manifesting in a way? You know, that is, I guess the two questions are about that we are manifesting whether we like it or not, so right. We might as well manage it better. And number two, how do we get to that material?
Okay, so that's a good wise thing you said. You know, we're always manifesting. So then the question is, how do we manifest in a wise way? And some people manifest by holding back. And maybe that's not really, maybe it's, you know, shortchanging ourselves, we're just lost opportunity then. Some people manifest too much by going out, and sometimes that's right, and sometimes that's a lost opportunity. People say, you know, see that person coming, and please. But manifesting is, there's always manifesting, and how do we manifest? How do we step out of ourselves? And there's some risk involved then, because if you step out of yourself in manifesting, then you need time to afterwards to process that or look back and see what happened there. So you need to go back and forth. And the strength of the Vipassana scene is the seeing part. and the manifesting part hasn't been emphasized that much. It's getting to be more now as we're growing up as a tradition, but it's been mostly the seeing part. Zen tradition puts a lot more emphasis on manifesting. And you show up to talk to a Zen master, some master Zen masters, and try to explain your understanding. Show me your understanding. Don't tell me. So the question of subtle thoughts, you know, how do we access our subtle motivation, subtle conditioning that we have, that's often influencing our daily life in big ways, in unseen ways. And there's a lot of answers to that, and not just one way. Certainly meditation is one way. The stiller and more concentrated you get in meditation, certain kinds of subtlety can be accessed and seen. Sometimes retreats do that, and it's pretty common on retreats, people be shocked and surprised by the conditioning they see about in themselves that's not accessible in daily life. Other ways is, to just stay within the Buddhist tradition, is to work closely with a teacher. Sometimes by working closely with a teacher can point out your blind spots or point out what's going on. And that can work very powerfully even on retreats where, you know, again, some of the subtle issues are more closer to the surface, and sometimes a teacher can see them that you can't, and can mirror them back or challenge you there or somehow, you know, connect you there. And then there's all kinds of other ways. There's, you know, spending time in nature, going for walks, taking a vacation sometimes is helpful for some people to see what's going on. There's therapy, which is very helpful to do that. There is a lot of things. Sometimes it's interesting to do, certain kind of thinking, certain kind of relating to the world and ourselves happens in relationship to others, not alone. And one of the weaknesses, for example, of an introspective kind of Buddhism or an introspective kind of psychotherapy, where just you and the therapist individually, is that sometimes you don't really see what's going on in the overall social system, for example, a family system. So sometimes, for example, family therapy is really helpful, where the whole family comes to therapy together, so that and then certain things get manifested, some subtlety or some conditioning shows themselves that's very hard to show themselves when you're alone with a therapist, kind of telling the therapist your view of the family situation. And so sometimes taking risks is a good way. If you hold yourself back and are always very careful, you might not know what's going on. But if you take some risks, then sometimes it becomes clear. I know that in certain kind of situations where there's conflict, if the conflicted parties can have enough trust or enough healthy process that they agree on beforehand, then sometimes a very wise way of working with a conflict is by not being too careful what you say. Because if you're being too careful what you say, then the subtleties of your opinions and views and feelings are hidden for everybody. You're kind of polite and proper and politically correct and everything. And sometimes by being politically incorrect, will you find out what you really believe. Maybe being kind of fast, even quick in your response. And so setting up a certain situation where it's safe to be quick because you know the group is going to process it and work with it and hang in there is helpful. I know sometimes with people who do diversity work, like interracial diversity kind of racism work, looking at racism, and there might be people of color, and everybody's of color, I guess, but usually what they mean is white people, right? People of color and white people. But, you know, the oppressed and the oppressor, that sometimes the people who are oppressed, what they want from the oppressor is for the oppressor to be politically incorrect when they're doing that work, because they want to have it all out on the table. And then they can work with it, and then you can go deep. But if you're being politically correct, then you can't go very far. So sometimes in the right environment, you want to take risks and just put it all out there and you find out what's going on. So there's no end to answering your question. But that'll have to do for now. So thank you very much for today.